history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. Eye-opening stories, remarkable stories, inspiring stories. But the only way we get to hear them is if we ask a few questions and then take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Here in America and around the globe, we're all treading on uncertain ground in light of this coronavirus pandemic. It's interrupting life here in the U.S. to a degree that hasn't taken place since World War II. And along with that, of course, has come this new idea of social distancing that we're all trying to get used to. Since the men and women we hear from each week on Hometown Heroes are part of the highest risk age group, I'm not going to be visiting any nonagenarians until it's safe to do so. And it also means that the weekly Stories of Service class in Clovis, California won't be meeting for a while. The interview you're going to hear today was recorded in that class earlier this month. Since 2002, veterans have met every Monday morning at 9:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District, and with the patient encouragement of Janice Stevens, they've shared their military memories, which have even turned into multiple books. That class will resume meeting when it's safe to do so, so if you live in or around Clovis, California, I know they'd love to see you there. Often when I meet up with a veteran, there's nobody else in the room, and if there is, it's usually a spouse or a child or a close friend of the veteran. For today's conversation with 96-year-old Al Bloomer, he was surrounded by dozens of his fellow veterans spanning from World War II into more recent decades. And if you happen to hear an occasional echo effect, it's because our conversation was being piped through the speaker system so they could all get to know their friend Al a little better. I started out by asking him how long he'd been participating in that class.
Oh, many, many Mondays. I don't remember exactly when, but a lot of years. I sure enjoy it.
And I'm going to be taking you a lot further back because we're going to hear about World War II from beginning to end. You were in the Navy before Pearl Harbor happened, and through the finish line, the USS Enterprise, the most active ship in World War II, in more major engagements than any other ship. The legendary Big E is the ship that Al served on. But I want to take you further back. Before you got on the Big E, tell me about your childhood. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
I was born in Pennsylvania. And my dad, when I was about 4 years old, he decided he wanted to go to Alaska. Well, we got on a train, and as far as we got is California. I guess we ran out of money, and we settled in Dinuba, California. And that's where we was raised. I went to school there in Dinuba, from grammar school and so forth up into high school.
I wonder if you're the only family that's ever ended up in Dinuba trying to go from Pennsylvania to Alaska. I don't think that was the plan.
Yeah, but anyway, that's what happened. I have three sisters and two brothers. We are all together for a long time.
And today, you know, kids have a pretty different existence than I imagine you had back then in the 1920s and 30s. What can you tell us about your childhood, the things you had to do, what life was like?
One thing, when we lived out on the ranch there, I think it was in the fourth grade, and every year my dad would raise two pigs for butchering. And my job was to feed them in the morning and feed them at night. And I tell you, you better do it or you're going to be in trouble. But that's what it took. And then I used to ride the bicycle to the downtown where I went to school. So it was about 4 miles that I rode every morning and back. We didn't have buses in those days. We either walk or you rode your bike. And that was it.
And where did you fit into that birth order with your siblings?
I was the second one. I had a sister older than me. Yeah, she's still alive.
Still alive, older than you.
Yeah, she's a year and a half older than I am. She's 98.
Outstanding. So as the oldest boy, I'm sure you got the toughest jobs, right?
Well, yeah.
Like feeding the pigs.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of other things, too. But when we lived on the farm, we used to have to pick grapes and help with that, and then to make extra money. And believe it or not, I had to go out and pick up figs and put them in those 50-pound box. I think we got about the dime or 15 cents a box at that time. course, you know, that was a lot of money, too. And I usually always had to buy my own school clothes. I never got them donated or anything.
That's one of the things I'm always fascinated to hear, because I've talked to so many veterans of this era who said during that Great Depression, they felt it. They knew it was hard times. And others, depending on where they lived and what their situation was, they didn't realize how hard some other people had it. Did you see some evidence that this is not the way it's supposed to be, that these are definitely hard economic times?
No, I just thought it was one of those things that we just handled. And my dad was a carpenter there, and he worked too. My mom, she took care of all us kids. Every morning, they got us up. We didn't get to sleep in either. You had to get up, and I remember my two brothers are much younger than me. Regardless how cold it was outside, you just put some jackets on them and everything and put them outside there and play, not in the house. That's how it was, and we worked together.
I'm always curious, if you had a dream, an idea, an ambition as a child, hey, that someday when I grow up, here's what Al is going to do.
Well, I was kind of interested in airplanes or mechanics or something like that. And I thought, well, maybe one of these days. And later on, when I got this far, went in the Navy, I bought an old Model T car. I lived from the ranches. We moved into town because my dad was a carpenter there. So I bought an old Model T for $5 as a pickup. And we worked together, and another guy, my neighbor, had one too, and we were kind of hopping them up to get some power out of them, and I had parts laying around in the backyard, and it didn't look too good, but that's how I started working on mechanic stuff. We got it going, and sometimes we get in a neighborhood at that time, there was a strict on driving and so forth, a bunch of us kids would get together and had a bed on, and we'd push it and get it going, and we'd ride around the neighborhood. But a little lucky, we never got a ticket, I'll tell you.
I wonder what you could get for $5 today.
Not too much.
So, did you go to Dinuba High School?
Yes, uh-huh. I went 2 years there to Dinuba High School. You had 2 years, and you were 17 years old. And at that time, you could join the Navy. Well, this one guy and I used to hang around together. We used to get jobs, and then we used to deliver handbills for the theater there. And it was a little small town there. And he gave me a free ticket to the movie. Can you imagine? Instead of money. But anyway, he wanted to get in the Navy so bad. And I said, okay. I think at that time, I had finally got my driver's license early, but I don't remember how we got to Visalia. But anyway, that's where the recruiting office, they don't have them on every corner like they do now. And so we got down there and we took a test, and both of us passed. And then the recruiting guy, well, being 17, he had to come out to the house there and have my folks sign for me to go in. So they did. And then about a month later, or a week, a couple of weeks later, the recruiter come by and says, okay, you guys, get your gear together. We're going to ship you to San Francisco for a physical examination. Why you ever ship you up there when you're going to go down to San Diego? I never know. But anyway, we get up there, and boy, he was really gung-ho, man. We're going in the Navy. Yeah, right, wrong. We get the physical, and lo and behold, they passed me, but they didn't pass him because he was colorblind. Can you imagine? At that time. Anyway, I stayed in, and here I go on down there. And they had a group of us. We got on a train, and we rode it down to San Diego. So that's where I went, trained there for about 6 weeks.
And this is July of 41?
Yeah, uh-huh.
So you kind of got suckered into the Navy.
Yeah. Yeah, you might say that, yeah.
How did your folks feel about it? They had to sign for you.
Well, they thought I wasn't going to make it. But I did. Well, my dad was in the Navy, too. He was in the World War One, and he was a coxswain on a hospital ship. Now, he never did get much information on him like you have nowadays. So that's one reason I stayed in there.
A couple more things about before you went in the Navy. Those 2 years you spent at Dinuba High School, you remember what their mascot is?
Yeah, Emperors. Yeah, right. Yeah, Emperors, yeah.
Well, that's a little ironic given who you'd be fighting against not long after you left Dinuba High School.
Yeah.
The Emperor of Japan was not a Dinuba Emperor. The other thing I'm curious about, because of that part of the San Joaquin Valley and what happened during this time period, I imagine those years you went to school, you must have had some Japanese-American classmates, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I had some good fellows. I was in scouting before I went into the service a few years before. And we had the Japanese people in our troop and that. We all got along. We didn't at that time. We didn't even think about it, to be truthful.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of folks who were here in California when Pearl Harbor happened, and they saw, and I've talked to a lot of the Nisei veterans who were here, and how that happened for them and how they were forced out of their homes and sent to the internment camps. But you're already in the Navy. Were you getting wind of that from where you were?
No, I didn't even know anything about it, no.
Until afterwards, huh?
Yeah.
So let's focus on your experience then. You go in July of 41. Did you have any inkling that a war might be imminent?
At the time when I first went in, I didn't, no. After boot camp, you know, a lot of this, they had rifle manual of arms and so forth and semaphore. Well, I knew all that stuff because when I was in Danube, we had a ROTC program there, and they had to learn all that, which I joined, and I knew the manual of arms and how to march and everything. And then in scouting, we had semaphore. We didn't have all these fancy radios that they have nowadays. And in the Navy, I knew all the semaphore and everything, so I got by real easy, and tying knots and so forth. I knew all that stuff. That really prepared me for all the activities in boot camp.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do in the Navy, what your specialty would be, or what kind of ship you wanted to be on?
Well, no, I didn't know about the different ships at that time, but I wanted to be a mechanic for airplanes. That's what I wanted to do. So they gave us a bunch of tests. I guess my score wasn't quite high enough to go to school. So they signed me at that time. Afterwards, the boot camp, they signed me to the Enterprise. Well, the Enterprise was over in Pearl Harbor, so they said, okay, we're going to send about 10 of you guys are going to go down to San Pedro and get on this tanker. And this tanker was the Neosho. So he said, oh boy, it's going to take it 3 days to get over there. Well, you know the Navy, and 3 days, they ain't going to let you lay around. So what they do, they put a paintbrush in your hand and you start painting every day. And then when we got over there, they decided, well, the Enterprise outside, so they rounded us up, about 10 of us guys, and they put us on a motor launch, and lo and behold, they took us over, and it was put before the Enterprise came in, put us over and put us on one of these old battleships. They were all in port at that time. Of course, your sea bag was everything that you owned, including your mattress and everything. And that thing was so heavy, I think it weighed more than I did. And when I go clawing up those planks, I damn near lost mine. But anyway, they took us over, and they said, oh, okay, here's where you guys are going to sleep. They didn't have bunks like they did on the carrier. They slept in hammocks on this old battleship, and they lived out of your sea bag, and they had like a trough on it. And he said, okay, you guys, you put your sea bag here, and I'll show you where you hang your hammock. And he says, okay, Al, your hammock's going to be right here, and so forth. And he says, you take it down every day. And just about that time, some guy comes back and says, oh, no, you guys don't belong here. You got to go over to the Saratoga. Oh, boy, here we go again. You got to pack everything back up again. Back home and go through all that again. So they put us on a motor launch. We go over to Saratoga. We have to wait on the Saratoga until the Enterprise come in. Well, the Enterprise wasn't going to come in for a couple of days. So they put us on there, and here we got in a bunk that they had, and they put us to work again. And guess what we had to do? Well, at that time, the uniform of the day was T-shirts, white shorts, and socks, and black shoes. Well, we didn't have any, but they finally found some initiatives to it. So they said, that's what you wear during the day, and until you get transferred. Well, here again, what do you think they had us do? Paint. You know what we painted? The flight deck. Can you imagine? With a mop. Oh, I'll tell you, never before. All right. And then finally the Enterprise comes in, and then they get us all together again, and then we get transferred to the Enterprise, and then they line us up on the hangar deck. You come up on the hangar deck, and they says, okay, I want you and you, and you're going to this division. They didn't ask you what you wanted to do or anything. You and you going here. And, oh, well, you know, he didn't luck out. He gets the deck division. He gets a ship's company in the deck division. And their duty was to take care of the forecastle and officer company and so forth. Well, that was okay. But, you know, when I went aboard there, you know, I never knew there were so many different bugle calls. Every 5 minutes, the old bugle will go and the old bosun will say, now hear this, so and so and so. And anyway, part of the seaman's job was, too, that they had to have the motor launch. Well, he gets assigned to a motor launch, but I don't remember a motor launch bugle call or like that. And they said away so many motor launch or boat and so forth. I never did hear mine, and I'm just kind of waiting around. And also, now hear this, Seaman Blumer report to the quarter deck. I'm in problem. I come to find out they had it, but I didn't know it. The other part of the crew kind of filled in on for me, and they come by the gangplank there. Okay, the old officer of deck says, I'll say, is that Blumer? He says, don't you know what your call is? And I says, no. He said, well, by God, you better learn it. He said, if you can't remember it, sleep in the damn motor launch. And I said, okay, very good, sir. Then I get my duty. But I mean, there are little things when you first go in, I'll tell you. Everything's so much noise, and aboard the ship I was on. And, you know, you have flight quarters, general quarters, then you got the motor launch, and you got the captain's gig, and you got the admiral's gig, and so forth. And each one is different, bugle, and fire drill, and general quarters. Of course, you always know general quarters. You never forget that.
And I imagine there's a few veterans in this room who are identifying with some of those stories that you shared, right? Especially you Navy guys. Hey, but I've got to ask you, Al, before I forget, and maybe you were coming to this anyway. They're moving you from this tanker, the Neosho, to a battleship. You didn't tell us the name of the battleship. And then to another carrier, the Saratoga, before you end up on the Enterprise. And we're going to hear about everything the Enterprise went through. But I'm sure you're aware of what went on those other ships that you almost ended up on.
Oh, yeah, well, Pearl Harbor, I really don't remember. It was kind of in the center. I don't remember which battleship it was
on. Which battleship?
Yeah, it was in the center more of Tennessee or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which had heavy damage there, too.
Oh, yeah, they all did. I could kind of pick it up, had a picture, but I don't have anything with me yet.
Well, wasn't the Neosho the one that got blown up?
The Neosho down there in the Battle of the Coral Sea, it got sunk down there. They refueled the Lexington and the Yorktown. Then that left the task force with one destroyer for protection, and the Japanese caught them by themselves there, and they sunk them both, and the Neosho too. But anyway, that was another. That's one we missed, but that's about the only one I can remember.
Well, and good thing you weren't on the Neosho. Good thing for you. But on the Big E, so you're finally part of that ship's crew, and you told us about some of the fun things you got to do on that giant aircraft carrier. What were you guys doing in the days leading up to December 7th, 1941?
Well, the ship's company, before December, we'd always go out to sea there, and then we'd qualify pilots, and then we'd come back in for a couple of days and get some liberty. Anyway, before the war, we took those Marine fighters to Wake Island, those 16 Marine fighters to Wake Island. Well, you know, Admiral Hosley was on our ship there, had put out a letter saying that we were under war conditions. He brought up all ammunition up into the guns. We were all prepared for war. The airplanes were all armed. Bombers had bombs on them and everything. They didn't put torpedoes on the torpedo planes until they actually found the enemy. However, we never did. We got within a few 100 miles or so of the Wake Island, and we launched all the 16 fighters. Well, the Marines, the pilots, were not too familiar flying at sea there with no recognition of land spots or anything, so they sent a couple SPDs with them to escort them to Wake Island. And then the SPDs, of course, wartime, we waited for them to come back. They were stationed there when the Japanese attacked it. Then on the way back, after we was ready to go into Pearl there, before we got there, we hit a part of a storm. We hit the storm, so that would make, and we had to refuel the destroyers because the old Admiral Osley, he was a captain of a destroyer, and he knew how rough it was for the sailors on him, so he made us a day late.
Well, and that would turn out to be a good thing for the Enterprise and for the Navy that the Enterprise was late getting back to Pearl Harbor. I mean, if that storm hadn't hit.
Right, yes, otherwise we'd have been, I don't know. might not have been here.
And he's still here. In fact, it wasn't too long that he was honored by American Legion Post 147 in Clovis, California for 75 years of continuous Legion membership. I think you can tell Al Bloomer's memories are still crystal clear. So what does he remember about coming into Pearl Harbor after the infamous attack? What about the Doolittle Raid and the Battle of Midway? There's much more to come with one of our last living links to the aircraft carrier that was involved in more major actions against the Japanese than any other ship in World War II, the USS Enterprise. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.